It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Live from Everywhere USA, it's Fox Across America with Jimmy Failla.
Welcome to Fox Across America. I'm your guest host for today, Ben Domenech. Jimmy is off doing some kind of crazy thing, I'm sure, that we'll all have to answer about at press conferences in the future. How does this man get himself in so many different pickles whenever it comes time for Christmas vacation? I am happy to be here with you today, where we have a ton of things to talk about. We have the craziness going on in our airports with Southwest Airlines. We have this horrible story regarding the actions of Twitter in recent years that has been at the top of mind for so many different people in terms of the level to which we had government entities and the Biden team affecting the way that we discussed things here in America of the utmost importance in ways that I think, you know, are really a danger to the entire American conversation and to the faith that we place in government officials. But I have to start off by saying I was really impressed with a number of different people in terms of their performances this year when it came to the media, their commentary, and the impact that they had on our national conversation. And one of those people who has impressed me, as I'm sure has impressed many of you, is Tulsi Gabbard, the former congressman from Hawaii, who has been obviously an ever-present force here on Fox in a number of different capacities over the past year, and had the opportunity last night to interview someone at the center of a real maelstrom in terms of the post-midterm conversation, and that's the representative-elect from New York's 3rd Congressional District, George Santos. She had a conversation with him that I hope you take the time to watch in full, because it really was, I think, an example of how a tough interviewer can come from a lot of different backgrounds. And frankly, you know, it's an example of how little the kind of faith that we can have in our existing media establishment really is put there in the right place. She really held this elected representative feet to the fire over the fact that his, it turns out, much of his biography seems to have been invented out of thin air. In a really disturbing way. Let's listen to some of the things that George Santos had to say last night on Fox News to Tulsi Gabbard. Cut 11.
My heritage is Jewish. I've always identified as Jewish. I was raised a practicing Catholic. I think I've gone through this. Even I've not being raised a practicing Jew, I've always joked with friends and circles, even with in the campaign, I'd say, guys, I'm Jewish. Remember, I was raised Catholic. So, look, I understand everybody wants to nitpick at me. I'm going to reassure this once and for all. I'm not a facade. I'm not a persona. I have an extensive career that I worked really hard to achieve, and I'm going to deliver from my experience because I remain committed in delivering results for the American people. I campaigned on inflation. I campaigned on crime. I campaigned on education. I campaigned on delivering resolve for the American people.
You know, and that's the sort of thing that you know, I think are used to hearing from politicians who are trying to spin their way out of a problem. But Tulsi really was not letting him have that kind of freedom. Let's listen to Cut 12.
I agree with what you're saying. And as I stated, and I continue, we can debate my resume and how I worked with firms such as Goldman
Sachs. Is it debatable or is it just false?
No, it's debatable or is it just debatable? No, it's not false at all. It's debatable. I can sit down and explain to you what you can do in private equity, in capital intro, via servicing limited partners and general partners. And we can have this discussion that's going to go way above the American people's head. But that's not what I campaigned on. I campaigned on delivering results for the American people by lowering inflation. I can sit down, and if you want to have that discussion, I'd be glad to, Tulsi, to explain that to you and make sure that we settle the score.
You know, I think that one of the things we need to understand is that we have, in recent years, put a lot too much faith, in my view, on local reporting to spool out the truth about various candidates for office. We've put too much faith in the existing media establishment to tell us the truth about candidates in ways that delve into their backgrounds and research their biographies, their resumes, and the like. And, you know, in a circumstance like this, where it turns out that, you know, at least according to the reporting that we have, Santos is basically, he's lied about the college that he went to. He's lied about the work that he's done. He's lied about the companies that he's worked for. And he's lied about a number of other aspects of his history. It now explains a little bit when he comes to saying that he considers himself Jewish, why he might refer to the prime minister of Israel as David Netanyahu, as he did recently. But I think that one of the things that we can take away from this is that those entities that we put our faith in, whether it's local parties or local media, they really don't do that good of a job anymore. I recall, you know, recently in Virginia, the whole experience that happened, you know, it seems like a distant memory now, where a Democrat governor had all of these, you know, horrible pictures that he participated in when he was in college. And then that led to a cascade of revelations about other top Democrats also having, you know, participated in black or brown face when they were in their college careers. All things that obviously you would think would come up in a campaign, especially a competitive campaign in a swing state, and yet none of that actually happened. And the real reason, of course, is that these dominant media entities, entities like the New York Times, like the Washington Post, are more than happy to look in the other direction when it comes to one side of the aisle. And then when it comes to covering, you know, Republicans and the like, their level of trust that they have from electorates is so low that even if they were to report some of these things out, it would come across as just trying to smear someone who they disagree with ideologically. But of course, this is not a unique problem when it comes to one side of the aisle. And as much as Democrats are arguing today that it would be an insult to seat Santos, that he's not someone who should ever be a member of Congress, the truth is that this is them ignoring the log in their own eye. Let's listen to some other things about another politician. Let's start with Cut 14.
I went to law school on a full academic scholarship, the only one in my class to have a full academic scholarship. Went back to law school and, in fact, ended up in the top half of my class. I was the outstanding student in the political science department at the end of my year. I graduated with 3 degrees from undergraduate school and 165 credits, only needed 123 credits.
Biden now concedes he did not graduate in the top half of his law school class, that he does not have 3 degrees from college, and that he was not named outstanding political science student in college.
Newsweek says Biden actually went to school on a half scholarship, ended up near the bottom of his class, and won only 1 degree, not 3.
Joe Biden ranked 76th in a class of 85 at the University of Syracuse Law School. I mean, this guy comes off this whole thing as a flyweight.
Now Biden says Newsweek is right. His memory had failed him.
And I'd be delighted to sit down and compare my IQ to yours if you'd like, Frank.
Joe Biden was victimized by the truth.
Cannot measure the health of our children.
The health of our children.
The quality of their education.
The quality of their education.
The joy of their play.
Or the joy of their play.
Biden gave Kennedy no credit. He has also quoted or paraphrased John Kennedy, Hubert Humphrey, and British Labour Party leader Neil Kinnock, all without credit.
3 degrees, I mean, that's a lot. That comment, that flyweight comment, by the way, from the great Mort Kondracki on the McLaughlin Group. I think that one of the things that we have to appreciate here is that when it comes to Joe Biden's past, everyone has been happy to look in the other direction. Throughout his continued and ridiculous tall tales that he's told over the past several years. Let's listen to Cut 15.
And if we don't drive an 18-wheeler, man.
Yeah.
I wish I got to.
So I became a full professor at the University of Pennsylvania.
This day, 30 years ago, Nelson Mandela walked out of prison. I had the great honor of meeting him. I had the great honor of being arrested with our UN ambassador on the streets of Soweto trying to get to see him on Robben's Island. When he came to the United States, and I said, Mr. President, he leaned, I said, thank you. Thank you for trying to come and see me.
And a guy named Angelo Negri came up, he goes, Joey, baby, grabs my cheek like that. And I thought they're going to shoot him. I really did. I said, no.
Corn Pop was a bad dude. And he ran a bunch of bad boys. And so he was up on the board, wouldn't listen to me. I said, hey, Esther, you, off the board, or I'll come up and drag you off. And he said, I'll be waiting for you. He was waiting for three guys in straight razors.
And it's not like this is a problem that's gone away over the course of Joe Biden's career. Just listen to this from just the last couple of weeks, Cut 16.
You know, my dad, when I got elected vice president, he said, Joey,
Uncle Frank fought in the Battle of the Bulge. He was not feeling very well now, not because of the Battle of the Bulge, but he said, and he won the Purple Heart, and he never received it. He never got it. Do you think you could help him get it? We'll surprise him. So he got him the Purple Heart. He had won it in the Battle of the Bulge. And I remember he came over to the house, and I came out, and he said, present it to him. Okay, we had the family there.
You know, I think that one of the things that we have to understand is that we're dealing with someone who isn't just telling lies that shade the truth in one direction or the other. Or in the old way of looking at Biden, the idea that he was just sort of telling big fish stories where he would take something that was fundamentally true and then he would just slightly exaggerate it. You know, that's something that a lot of politicians tend to do. They always are trying to make themselves look bigger and stronger and better. But so many of these incidents that Biden says repeatedly, not just in interviews, but on the campaign trail to huge audiences and the like over the years, are completely invented. They're actually impossible. If you reconstruct the timelines in question, it doesn't line up at all, including people who died before he said that he did certain things for them while he was vice president, including, you know, him crossing certain mileage counts when it came to use of Amtrak or use of Air Force Two, and then being complimented for it by people who had retired and then passed away before these things ever happened. And then, of course, when it comes to, you know, his own history, you know, the very first time that, you know, he was even introduced to people on the campaign trail and fell apart in those first hits, it was because he was not just, you know, inflating his own achievements, inflating his own resume in ways that we're used to from politicians. He was stealing other people's stories about their own lives and repeating them as if they were his. It's a pretty amazing thing that this guy ever ended up in the presidency, given all of this. And yet, when it comes to our existing media, they are totally willing to look the other way, to pretend that this is not something that is a problem, to pretend that it is not indicative of maybe a more serious problem with Joe Biden than just the fact that he continues to tell these fictional made-up stories. And because of that, when they are blasting over and over again on their airwaves the idea that someone like George Santos can't be seated as a member of Congress because, despite the fact that voters supported him, that just, to me, seems a complete indictment of their own approach to the way that they cover the different sides of the political aisle. Look, George Santos seems to me like an irresponsible dude and someone who, you know, clearly has fooled a lot of people over the course of his tenure. We'll see what he's like when he gets to Congress. But I'm sorry, I can't believe that you actually have this level of outrage for people who've invented all these things when you're still defending the guy who says that he got arrested trying to meet Nelson Mandela, something that literally never happened. I'm Ben Domenech. You are listening to Fox Across America, where I am your guest host in Jimmy Failla's seat for the day. We'll be back with more right after this.
You're listening to the best dad on the radio.
Can't believe you forgot my birthday.
You're with Jimmy Failla on Fox Across America. Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back, Fox Across America. Today, I'm in the seat for Jimmy Failla. I'm Ben Domenech. Happy to be with you today and hope you're all doing your best to recover from the holidays. We've been talking about George Santos, and we're going to talk more about it with John Levine of the New York Post. He is on Twitter, at Levine Jonathan. He'll be coming up in the next segment. But before we get to that, I wanted to just talk a little bit more about contrasts in the way that the media covers certain things. You know, look, we all know about Joe Biden's history when it comes to inflating his resume and inventing things that didn't happen, insisting that they happened over and over and over again, and eventually, in some cases, being forced to apologize or retract them. One thing in particular, though, that I think that we can all understand is how different approaches are used when it comes to similar actions on his part. You probably are aware at this point that the president and his family are vacationing in St. Croix, U.S. Virgin Islands. It's a place that they've gone regularly before. He's moved the whole family down there, and there's some pictures that have been posted online by various media folks of their arrival. Of course, this is coming at the same time that there is this massive series of problems happening here at home, thanks to a blizzard and snowstorms that have killed more than 50 people, that have led to the snarling of all types of air travel. We'll talk about that in a second. But just consider the difference in approach, the difference in the way that the media talks about something like this, the president of the United States going on vacation to a nice warm place, at the same time that there's all sorts of major considerations back home and issues that have to be addressed, issues that have to be addressed, of course, by the executive branch, by people like Pete Buttigieg and others. Compare that to the way that they covered it when someone who doesn't have executive responsibilities, Senator Ted Cruz, went with his family to Cancun, Mexico, during the Texas ice storm. CNN and other places covered it this way. Senator Ted Cruz and his family flew to Cancun, Mexico, as a winter disaster in his home state of Texas left millions without power or water, according to photos posted on social media and confirmed to CNN by a person familiar with the travel itinerary. Compare that to, again, from CNN, President Joe Biden this week returns to St. Croix, one of his and First Lady Jill Biden's beloved vacation spots, seeking a final opportunity for rest before what is expected to be a contentious 2023 and re-election run. We all see what's going on. It's not a mystery, and they don't do any of themselves a good job of hiding it anymore. They are completely and totally beholden to a partisan frame on all of these things, where when a Republican takes his family on vacation, even if he has no direct responsibility over the state response to a major weather event, and a president who they like goes on vacation, it's just a completely different approach. Look, these travel concerns are significant, but I think that unfortunately we have a group of people in charge right now who we simply can't trust to be responsible when it comes to delivering on any of the different changes and shifts that need to be done. Let's listen to cut 17 from Pete Buttigieg.
Well, meltdown is the right word. This is an unacceptable situation. Bottom line is the rest of the aviation system has been on the road to recovery since the worst days of the storm going into Friday of last week. As of today, as I'm looking at the different airlines, most of them are in the low single digits in terms of cancellation rates, averaging about 5% for all of the other airlines. For Southwest right now, we appear to be north of 70%. So their system really has completely melted down. And I've made clear that our department will be holding them accountable for their responsibilities to customers, both to get them through this situation and to make sure that this can't happen again.
Look, I just want to point out something here. Pete Buttigieg is held up by the same media, the same biased media that participates in all of these different stories in ways that are designed to run interference for Democrats. He's held up by them as being a potential chief executive, a potential future president of the United States. They talk about how intelligent and bright he is, how capable he is, and the like. And yet, is it just me? Ever since he's taken over as in his role as head of the Transportation Department, haven't things just gotten worse? We've had rail strikes. We've had all of these different problems when it comes to the airlines. We just don't have any sign of competence. And that's because people in the media don't actually care about competence anymore. They just care about their team winning, and that means Democrats. I'm Ben Domenech. You're listening to Fox Across America. We'll be back with more with John Levine right after this. And we're back on Fox Across America. I'm your guest host for today, Ben Domenech. Jimmy Failla is out doing whatever crazy things Jimmy does this time of year. I'm sure that we'll find out and have some great laughs over whoever has to go and bail him out. And I'm happy to be joined right now by John Levine, who is a reporter for the New York Post, someone who you can follow on Twitter at LevineJonathan, as I do myself. John, thanks so much for taking the time to join me today.
Thanks for having me. Ben, no one's going to have to bail him out. This is New York. We don't have bail anymore. Walk out of jail. No,
that's
problem.
A great point. That's a great point. But, you know, he'll find a way. I believe in Jimmy. He'll find a way to test the boundaries of that. He's an amazing man. So, John, I know that you have been paying attention to this crazy story with George Santos, and I wanted to get your perspective on it. I think a lot of people have the assumption that, you know, people like this, they get looked at by parties. They get looked at by the media. Someone will tell us if there's something, you know, untoward or missing or false on their resume, that kind of thing. And yet that didn't happen in this case. Why didn't it happen?
Well, it's, you know, it's tough. The midterms, there was a lot of races to look at. And we had in New York, everyone was looking at the governor's race, really. Mm-hmm. That was where all of the attention of the New York press was. You know, when it comes to Santos, I know that the DCCC did an opposition research book where a number of things in the book were things that ultimately came out. But the serialness of how so many different things were lies and piecing together that it wasn't just one misstatement, but really a much more systemic pattern, that's what everyone missed before the election. And, you know, Santos didn't have a primary challenger. And that's true in 2020 when he ran and 2022. In 2020, that was, no one thought he would beat Swazi. Nobody was looking too close into that. But in this race, it was a real race. And I can tell you on very good authority, when he wrapped up the nomination, Republicans, knew about him. Republicans knew there were a lot of stuff with him that didn't add up. But at that point, you can't do anything. He's already the nominee. So they just kind of sat on it and were sort of just let the chips fall where they may. And they were quite surprised that it never came out. And now he's in Congress. And here we are.
You know, one of the things that is so funny about this is that, you know, in this wasn't a wave election, obviously, in the way that Republicans expected. But one of the things that does happen when you have the kind of success that you saw Republicans have in a state like New York is that some random people end up winning. And sometimes they're people who haven't been as thoroughly vetted as people might expect. You know, he's obviously, getting pressure from all the normal sources. CNN and MSNBC have been, running things nonstop this morning, going after him calling for him to step down or something like that. But my assumption is that Republicans are going to stand lockstep with him, especially considering that, as much as this is embarrassing, it's not like he didn't win.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. There's a lot of smoke and there's a lot of effort to stir up a lot of dust about what the story is here. He lied about, I guess, working at Goldman Sachs. He lied about graduating college. He lied about being Jewish. He lied about personal details. None of those things are a crime. Elizabeth Warren lied about being a Cherokee Indian for most of her career and billed herself as the first Native American university professor at Harvard. Is she resigning over that? No. Richard Blumenthal lied about serving in the Vietnam War. Is stolen valor something that you resign over? Apparently not either. What Santos has right now is stolen yuppie. He's impersonating a Wall Street fat cat when he's apparently not, but not a crime. Now, if it veers into criminal territory, there's still the question of where his money comes from. There's still the question of there's some weirdness on his federal election disclosures, then it's a different story. But right now, nothing at all that's resignable. And most importantly, he's a safe vote for Kevin McCarthy, who needs every single vote he can get now. So no pressure coming from there.
Yeah, I think that this circumstance might be different if you had the kind of majority that a lot of Republicans had hoped that they would get. But given how close things really are, I assume that they're going to stick by him. Talk to me a little bit, though, about the hypocrisy here, because I think this is such an obvious point. He obviously inflated his resume, inflated his personal story, et cetera. But we have a president who does that on a regular basis, on a weekly, sometimes daily basis, invents these stories about himself and his past experiences that he had. The Nelson Mandela is my personal favorite just because it's just so obviously false, and yet he keeps telling it. He almost told it to Drew Barrymore just the other day.
Amazing.
I don't know if you have a favorite, but it's one of these things where, we have this guy in the White House right now who has a much bigger problem with this thing.
My favorite actually is where he claimed he hit a home run at a congressional baseball game.
That is a great one.
That's nobody great remembers. But it's very hard to pick a favorite because there's so many whoppers. And it's incredible how the media there. I think the New York Times, even 6 weeks ago, did a story. And it was something to the effect of, well, Biden's occasional embellishments sometimes veer into mystery, into falsehoods. And I think they called it folksiness. And it was like, oh, sweet Grandpa Joe occasionally goes off script. It's like, it isn't just they're trying to sort of just, oh, it's senility. It's not senility. He's been doing this his whole career.
Yes.
It's a very good shell game to be, oh, it's Grandpa Joe is just, you know, he's doing like a, you know, just going off again. But it's not.
Yeah, I mean, it's the old Abe Simpson thing. It's the onion in your belt story, you know.
They're trying to Grandpa Simpson it when it's much more pathological.
Oh, yeah. And the thing that is, you know, obviously untrue, too, is that, you know, in so many instances, these are stories that go directly to things that he did or he claims to have done while he was vice president or while he was in the U.S. Senate. And then, of course, you look into them and they all fall apart. So it's not like it's, you know, some – in other words, Corn Pop is funny, but Corn Pop doesn't really bother me, you know, in the sense that it's so ancient and it's so irrelevant to his political story. But when you are telling these lies about your own political experience in so many aggressive ways, it's a very big problem. And to me, you know, that's the sort of thing to look back at Santos. We'll see what he's like when he actually gets to Congress. Because,
and I think that's going to be the standard.
Mm-hmm, yeah. I mean, it's one of these things where, you know, we people have sort of banked in the idea that all politicians lie. But I think that they are more willing to, you know, sort of forgive people if it's resume embellishment versus people who, you know, are lying once they get into the job of doing the task for the American people who elected them. So when it comes to the attitude of New York Republicans toward George Santos, is it all just kind of eye rolling at this point that they're just like, well, that happened?
I mean, it's not great. Like, he's facing some – I know, like, the Republican-Jewish coalition has barred him from coming back. And his – you know, Long Island went all Republican this year, mm-hmm. all four seats. Santos was part of that wave. I know that a number of the newly elected Republicans, like Lalota, have come out with statements condemning him. And it's not – you haven't seen – you know, I expected a lot of silence, but you're actually seeing negative statements coming out. You know, there's I've always had a saying – only your own side can cancel you.
Yeah.
You can never be canceled by the other side. Like, you know, the liberal media can hem and haw about Santos forever, but it's only when your own side starts turning on you that you actually the wheels start to come off. So
Al Franken learned that the very hard way, yes.
Right. So again, there's no real danger before January 3rd and the leadership vote. But there will be, I mean, I think some kind of House and ethics probe is inevitable. Mm-hmm. Letitia James, our attorney general, one of the most partisan state attorney generals in the country, definitely is going to start looking under the hood of everything he said, particularly with the fake charity. Mm-hmm. If there's anything there, I mean, a lot of people are looking, and if there is illegality found, then it's going to get much harder for him, mm-hmm. I think.
You know, we'll see where these things lead. He didn't do a good job for himself the other night when Tulsi was putting him right in the crosshairs. And I think that there is a possibility that, as you say, something could turn into something more significant down the road. And at that point, the party will have to assess what to do about it. John Levine, thank you so much for taking the time to join me today. And Merry Christmas and Happy New Year.
Merry Christmas. Happy New Year too, Ben.
Take care. You can follow Jonathan Levine on Twitter at Levine Jonathan. He's a reporter for The New York Post. I'm Ben Domenech. You are listening to Fox Across America. I'm not Jimmy Failla, but I'm happy to be joining you today as your guest host and guiding you through all of these different storylines. We'll be back with more right after this.
It's the show that leaves you hungry for more.
We'll probably sit around and cook some soup, eat bread and desserts, and just get all fat and sassy.
This is Fox Across America with Jimmy Failla.
And we're back on Fox Across America. I'm your guest host today, Ben Domenech, in Jimmy Failla's seat for the next couple of hours. And I wanted to close out this hour by talking a little bit about what this year has meant for so many different people. You know, 2022 was a really hard year, I think, for many Americans, we're still dealing with the ramifications of COVID policies that were frankly ill thought and not really interested in the long term, that didn't really put the needs of the citizens that we have first, that didn't certainly put the needs of the kids that we have in our communities first. When it comes to the school closures and the like that were maintained for so long and that you know have been continually pushed for by teachers' unions that put their own interests and their ability to, frankly, hold kids' education hostage in order to try to extract more money from the government is really a disappointing and terrible thing that we're going to have to look back on and remember for the mistakes that so many different adults made that put so many children far behind when it came to their education and their ability to just function in a normal society. And one of the things that I'm really concerned about, considering the leadership that we currently have in Washington, concerning the leadership that we have in the White House, and the degree to which we've politicized our CDC, our FDA, and our HHS, that we are going to continue to see the kind of top-down recommendations from the federal government that are going to be used in blue states governed by blue leadership to essentially keep us in a rotating experience of permanent pandemic and lockdown. It's going to be something that I think is, unfortunately, what we're going to have to live with for the next couple of years. It's an immediate ramification to the fact that Republicans, as much as they've been able to take control of the House of Representatives, as much as they've been able to kind of hold the line in certain respects, that they still are not in any kind of majority that allows them to affirmatively pass the kind of steps that need to be taken. I was reading just the other day the frustration expressed by Rochelle Walensky at the CDC about bipartisan steps that were being pushed forward by Patty Murray on the Democratic side and by Richard Burr on the Republican side in the U.S. Senate that would allow for a more political process when it comes to naming heads of the CDC, people in her position. And the fact that she would push back against that and basically, say that we need to double down on the authority, the limitless authority of bureaucrats to run our lives and to make the kind of recommendations that, again, have a trickle-down property that are used on the state and local level in order to reassert things that, frankly, we've learned based on enormous levels of medical evidence that they simply do not have any kind of effectiveness in terms of battling COVID or anything else. This whole triple-demic push that Walensky has engaged in on the airwaves across the country in recent weeks, talking about these things as if they are, once again, a demand an emergency posture from the government. These are the ways that people are going to continue to try to manipulate Americans in order to respond to their wishes. And when those Americans don't respond, they're going to engage in much further mandates and crackdowns, lockdowns, and try to exact pain where they can in order to force them to do the thing that they want them to do. I think it's incumbent upon all of us as Americans to push back against this, to be aware of what our media is doing, to be aware of what the dominant authorities within our bureaucracy are doing and are going to continue to do. And when you hear about these types of reports from, people who are, within significant positions funded by the taxpayers, you need to understand that they no longer believe that they work for you in any capacity. They believe that it's your job to just obey, to do what they tell you to do, regardless of whether they have done this, hundreds of times before, and then only afterwards learned that the things that they engaged in were either utterly ineffective, or in many ways they actually did the opposite of what they were attempting to do. They had more damaging effects than they did beneficial ones. And so I think it's incumbent upon all of us to really stand up against that, to be aware of it, to respond to it, and to speak out when we see it coming down. To just say, we're not going to do this thing. Things are not going to be the way that they used to be. We are not going to just assume that your expertise is one that outranks the expertise of others. We're not going to assume that you have all the answers. And we're not going to assume that a lockdown-based approach that a, you know, closing schools, that a, you know, mandating masks, that a, you know, sort of major push to try to get kids to take vaccines at earlier and earlier ages when it comes to COVID are going to have the kind of effects that you're promising us that they will. And I think that one of the things that, frankly, is, I believe, a silver lining coming out of all of this is that Americans, I think, are going to reassert their role as being directors of their own fates and directors of their children's fates when it comes to the way that they raise them and when it comes to the way that they live. Certainly, we've seen that happen within the educational construct where there is more freedom. But I think one of the biggest examples of this happened in recent weeks when it came to the White House continuing to push back against those on Capitol Hill, a bipartisan majority, by the way, that were in favor of getting rid of the vaccination mandate for members of the military. They've seen the ramifications of that. They've seen the negative, the downside of it when it comes to the experience of members of our military who just want to serve. And I think that, you know, it was a very positive development to see that kind of bipartisan majority on Capitol Hill push back against a White House that once again was out there saying, you know, well, you know, these members of Congress, they just Karine Jean-Pierre saying they care more, you know, about getting their own way than about the health of these military individuals, which is, of course, absurd. It's absolutely absurd. Now, we do need to be mindful, though, that when we see these things come down, we need to, I think, speak with a bit more grace when it comes to the efforts of these bureaucrats to try to manage our lives. And what do I mean by that? I just mean, let's not demonize them all. They simply, I think, really are completely in the wrong direction. They're completely in the wrong when it comes to their priority list, and they completely ignore all of the different evidence that conflicts with what they'd like to achieve. But they're also still Americans, and I think that they still actually are, for the most part, motivated with the American mindset of wanting to try to save the most lives of their fellow citizens. They're just heading in the wrong direction, and they're doubling down on the same misbegotten policies that they tried the last time around that didn't work, that won't work, and that will never work. And until they understand that shifts have happened in our American experience where we no longer invest in them the faith that we once did, they're going to continue to try to do that. I'm Ben Domenech. You're listening to Fox Across America. We'll be back with more with the second hour right after this.
Live from Everywhere USA, it's Fox Across America with Jimmy Failla.
Welcome back to Fox Across America. I'm your host for today, Ben Domenech, in Jimmy Failla's seat. He is out there causing trouble somewhere. If you see a man running around setting things on fire in your backyard, it's probably just Jimmy. He's probably just trying to stay warm. I am looking back at a list of things that happened in 2022 in the world of politics. And man, a lot of stuff happened that was very, very bad. And you know, look, I don't think that's news to any of you. You've seen what's happening on our southern border, what's continued to be a major crisis that has come and is completely ignored by those in the White House and in positions of authority to do anything about it. And with their aid and abetting in the media generally, they have gotten away with ignoring the major problems and the historic highs of migrants pouring across our southern border, as our own Bill Melugin has covered. You know, I went down to Eagle Pass earlier this year in order to see what was happening there firsthand. It had been quite a while since I'd been to the southern border in a major hotspot like that. I've gone many times over the years. I went and surveyed the whole thing from Brownsville to El Paso and back again over the years. And it's one of the things that I think everyone should be required to do. It's kind of amazing that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris avoid it so studiously when it comes to the issue in question. One of the things that I think is really revelatory about this is that, you know, these are very tiny communities for the most part, communities that don't have the kind of infrastructure necessary to support the influx of thousands of people all at once. And so, you know, you may see those images of people pouring across as being something that looks horrible, but you don't really know what to do anything about. Well, the people who are down there, they don't know what to do about it either. All they can really do is stick them on a bus, send them somewhere that may or may not get them actual help. You'll have all these NGOs that are funded with taxpayer dollars and private donations as well that are supposed to take care of them. But, you know, for the most part, they just are getting shipped around in ways that are absolutely terrible for them. And so when you saw this kind of incident that was happening earlier this year, whether at the behest of Governor Greg Abbott or the behest of Florida's Ron DeSantis, to send migrants to other parts of the country just to send a message. And the reaction from those local officials that was completely over the top and saying, you know, that, you know, this is going to strain us. This is going to, you know, put us in a horrible position. We're not able to deal with all of the people who are here. And it's like, welcome to the party, pal. I mean, this is what the experience has been for people in Eagle Pass, you know, for a very long time. And it's going to only continue, unfortunately, in the coming years without any kind of change in policy. This border crisis is something that, you know, you cannot really deal with in a patchwork manner. You have to actually have a comprehensive solution for it that deals with all of its different aspects. And yet that's exactly what this government has been doing under Joe Biden, because if they were going to actually take a comprehensive approach, it would require them to do a lot of things that progressives would be mad at them for, because, frankly, they would look a lot like what happened under the previous presidency. That's something that they just can't come to grips with. And yet it's also something that, unfortunately, is putting the lives of all of these different migrants and, of course, those who are guarding our borders at risk in serious ways that, frankly, are anathema to me. I mean, it's one of these things that I just don't understand why we can't get it through the heads of people who are in Washington or the Acela corridor, who really do, you know, have these fanciful ideas about the way that immigration happens on the southern border, that they need to actually have a solution for this problem. And until they do, that this chaos is only going to continue to hurt their political cause. And the reason I say that is that as much as you might say that, you know, Democrats want to have this heavy influx of people because they want to change the electorate or they want to change the nation in terms of its makeup in different respects, I actually think that this level of chaos is something that only makes people more suspicious of the side that claims to be in favor of immigration and of immigrants. You know, because these are the people, you know, when they're coming across, they are victims too. They are being trafficked by these cartels. They are spending every dime that they have in order to get across. You know, many of them are bad people, but they also are desperate people. And they're trying to get across because they think that they can find work and a better life here than they have in their existing countries. And they're probably right about that. But of course, what ends up happening, you end up having to raise taxes in order to pay for them. They get put on these permanent welfare programs that don't actually do a good job. You know, they end up in, going from community to community and never really adapting to the nature of the communities that they're in. And I think that what you're going to see over time is that this is going to turn into something that I think is going to be a really generational failure on the part of our political leadership. You know, the fact is that the last 10 years that we've experienced when it comes to immigration and migrants on the southern border has been one that has dramatically increased the funding that is going to the cartels from this level of trafficking. It's dramatically increased the flow of drugs into America, the fentanyl that is completely devastating communities across the country. And it's done so in ways that I think are deeply irresponsible, that demand a response from any kind of serious approach from a political standpoint, a policy standpoint. And yet none of the people that we currently have in leadership are doing that. Why are they looking away? Why are they not able to actually approach this with the level of seriousness that it demands? Well, I think part of it has to do with the fact that they're stuck in a very old way of thinking about these issues. They still think, I think on the part of a number of Republicans, that if they stress the immigration issue, that in some way it's going to turn off Hispanic voters. That simply isn't the case. And you don't just have to look to Donald Trump's success with winning Hispanic votes in order to make the case for that. The fact is that Hispanic voters who are here legally, are absolutely abhor the kind of images that they see and, you know, frankly, are not interested in policies that are designed to have a porous border. At the same time, I think that there are a lot of Democrats who use the same type of talking points that they've been using since the Bush era, when this was a story that had to do mostly with migrant workers who were male, who were younger, who were trying to just come here, find work, and then send money back home. That's not the case anymore. These are families. These are people with young kids, many of whom are getting treated horribly during the trafficking process. They're being raped. They're being abused. And, you know, this is the type of thing that is absolutely abhorrent and should be an indictment of our current political leadership. But unfortunately, I don't think that you're going to have any kind of change in that until you have a change in leadership that is generational. It's something I talk about a lot. But I think that this younger generation of people who understand how much the border has changed, how much it's different than it was in the early 2000s when you had talk of guest worker packages and the like that could potentially have solved some of those problems. The fact is that this is a completely different environment now. It's a completely different circumstance and one that demands a much higher level of resources in order to secure the border, in order to prevent these types of crossings, and in order to discourage people from coming here in the way that they have. And by the way, I've seen over and over again people act as if the things that are said by Joe Biden, by Kamala Harris, and by other Democratic officials, that that's something that doesn't really translate. It absolutely translates. It's as if they think that people south of the border don't read the news, that they don't see the headlines. They can tell what's going on over here, and they can understand the different avenues and the different openings that they have in order to gain passage to this country. And they're going to make use of that information. It's as if people assume that they don't have the internet down there. It's ridiculous. It's the same way that they seem surprised when, you know, public reporting about various things, you know, was read by ISIS or Al-Qaeda back in the day and definitely had an impact on the way that they responded to the different moves that we made. You know, from the perspective of Western policy. Look, people absolutely read these things, and then they use those things in order to convince various families that they need to sell everything that they own in order to give the cartel all of their money in order to make it in time before things shut down. And that's the type of thing that they are doing repeatedly, and it's having a major impact, you know, not just here, but on, you know, on the other side of the border when it comes to chaos, when it comes to the ways that the cartels continue to use the existing frigid and incapable political regimes to their benefits. And unfortunately, I think it's not going to change anytime soon, particularly under this White House. We're going to have to wait through, I think, a very difficult period where this problem only continues before you have the White House willing to reengage in Trump-era policies that, frankly, as much as they dislike them on the left, actually worked. I'm Ben Domenech. You're listening to Fox Across America. We'll be back with more right after this.
The show that loves you like a sibling.
We'll always be brothers.
It's Fox Across America with Brother Jimmy Failla.
And we're back on Fox Across America. I'm your guest host for today, Ben Domenech. You can follow me on Twitter at BDominich. I'm the editor-at-large at The Spectator and a contributor to Fox News. And I'm also a friend of Jimmy, which means, of course, I'm deeply concerned about what kind of terrible things he's probably going to get himself involved in with his time off. Again, you know, if you see anyone setting fire to anything in your backyard, it's just Jimmy trying to stay warm. So just keep him in your sympathies and in your thoughts. And while John Levine in the last hour pointed out that you don't have bail in New York anymore, so we don't need to take up any kind of collection to try to support Jimmy and bail him out of whatever trouble he gets into, I'm sure he will find a way himself to navigate through that. I wanted to keep talking a little bit about one thing that happened in politics in 2022, something that I think we need to keep in mind because it's somehow kind of gotten on the back burner of our conversation. And that's, of course, the decision on the part of the Supreme Court to overturn Roe versus Wade. This took over the conversation for a time. You know, it seemed to surprise a lot of people that, you know, you had that type of decision come down from the court. But we, of course, got an early look at it thanks to a leaker, someone who has yet to be identified as a member of the Supreme Court staff or someone, you know, who perhaps was a clerk. And we still have no kind of information about what happened in that case. That's a deep concern, and it's something that we shouldn't forget about because it enabled, obviously, you know, not just the kind of reaction that we saw from the left when it came to, you know, their, you know, protest in the streets and in front of the homes of various justices. It also allowed for the targeting of justices, the intention on the part of people across, you know, social media, including one individual who was ultimately arrested, to perhaps alter the ultimate vote, the ultimate decision by murdering one of the justices. It put their lives at risk in a way that, you know, we have never seen before in terms of American politics. And for the institution of the court to have that type of thing happen, an institution where, you know, notoriously it's one of the few areas of American life where both sides still generally trust each other and do not, you know, have the kind of animosity that we see on Capitol Hill or in other areas where, you know, you can have different justices who are on opposite ideological sides who nonetheless still get along and have friendships and socialize together and trust each other. This is a situation where clearly someone who was connected to one of these justices or connected to the institution of the court made a decision that put their lives at risk in a very devious and horrible way. Now, I have gotten used to, you know, not getting the answers to all these different things that we want to get answers for. We all want to know whether COVID came from a lab leak or not. We all would like to know what the heck that Las Vegas shooter was ever doing. We all would like to know more about the real details of January 6th, details that unfortunately the January 6th committee was not interested in doing at all, since it was just a partisan effort on the part of Liz Cheney to work through whatever she's been going through over the past several years. But I think that one of the things that we need to understand is that this court situation, this leaking of an opinion, it may be the first time that this has happened, but it probably won't be the last. What is the next significant opinion that's going to be released in a certain way like this? Perhaps, you know, to the same types of journalists that were able to get access to it the first time around. What will be the ramifications of such a decision? You know, how will it play into, you know, the way people view the court? And especially if the decision ends up being different than the one in fundamentally ends up as the opinion of the court, what will people take away from that process? Look, we didn't know for sure that this was going to be the opinion that ultimately was released. Now, of course, as it turned out, it essentially resembled that that initial draft, you know, very closely. But if we had had the kind of situation where, you know, the votes change around and there's a different conclusion reached, then I think a lot of people would say, hey, the pressure campaign worked. You know, let's make sure that we do this type of thing again. Let's threaten the lives of justices and their families and their children again. And, you know, for people who live outside of the Washington, D.C. area and who are not familiar with the way that these people live their lives, the truth is that, you know, politicians don't tend to walk around with security guards surrounding them at all times. They don't tend to have families who have those types of security risks either. You know, and while there's exceptions to that, of course, if you're a very controversial person or if your family has received significant or real threats, then things will change. But the fact is that, you know, if you are a general, you know, member of a lot of different areas of our political life, including very important people, you just don't travel with that kind of security surrounding you at all times. And you particularly don't if you're the child of such a politician. We have to take this type of risk seriously. I do not think that we have the kind of answers that we deserve out of what happened with that decision and what happened with this release. And I think, frankly, that it is completely unconscionable that at this point, at the end of the year, we still don't have answers to such a deeply important question about the way that our process works. Imagine, if you will, a similar situation to what played out in Bush versus Gore, where the Supreme Court had to weigh in repeatedly on significant matters that ultimately would have an impact on who the next president of the United States was, coming out of the challenges that were being put in place by Al Gore in Florida. Ultimately, obviously, you know, in the Bush v. Gore decision, the decision was made to, you know, stop the count where it was, that there was not, you know, going to be a difference made up in what was remaining outstanding in terms of the vote. And we ended up with the presidency of George W. Bush by the slimmest of margins. If something like that were to happen again, and people have taken the lesson away that these members of the Supreme Court can be intimidated, that they can be moved by the fact that, you know, people are in front of their houses or identify them with a pin dropped on a map that they share on social media, or that they can identify the schools that their children go to and have a real impact in the decisions that they make. I can only imagine what kind of terrible things could result from a situation like that. So, of all the unanswered questions about our politics from 2022, I put to you that what we all deserve in the coming year is a real answer about who leaked the Roe v. Wade Dobbs decision ahead of time. Because if we don't have that answer, then I think it definitely will happen again. One more note on this. The Dobbs decision may have been a political factor in the 2022 midterms, but there isn't a single pro-life American that I know, Republican, Democrat, or independent, who wouldn't be in favor of that decision again today. They simply don't care in the way that the political consultants or the political class or the media do about the negative ramifications politically for the Republican Party or for the challenges that this presents to people who have to navigate the new abortion politics in America. They've been working for this result their entire lives, and everyone who favored getting rid of Roe v. Wade is happy because of it. You're listening to Fox Across America. I'm your guest host today, Ben Domenech. We will be back with more right after this. And we're back on Fox Across America. I'm your host, Ben Domenech, coming to you and talking to you about the year that 2022 was, and particularly the year that it was when it comes to politics. And joining me now is my friend Chris Bedford. You can follow him on Twitter at CBedfordDC. He is the executive editor of the Common Sense Society magazine. Chris, thanks so much for taking the time to join me today.
Great to be with you, Ben.
So in 2022, obviously, we had a lot of different storylines. We had the COVID storyline, we had the border storyline, we had high gas prices, we had baby formula shortages, we had all these different candidates that Republicans put their hopes in, most of whom did not deliver on the midterm election night. What are some of the big storylines that stuck out to you from politics in 2022?
Well, I think beyond politics, you kind of touched on it there with the baby formula shortage and with other shortages that we've seen with the fluctuating costs in meat, with the fact that you could walk into a food stand and see that the chicken fingers were market price, like you might see for oysters or for lobster or something like that. And this 2022 was the first year, I think, after COVID where the cracks in the system were really becoming obvious. The fact that everyone in the United States had just largely sent their kids to school over the past 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, 50 years, thinking that they were going to get a good education. They've gone to the grocery store expecting the shelves to be stocked. They've bought things from abroad expecting that the shipments wouldn't be stuck out in the harbor for months and months at a time. They've simply expected that the experts and the way things were would always work and everything would be fine. And these past couple of years, especially since COVID, have exposed how much is broken. It reminds me of that great essay from 2020, I think, called Everything is Broken, that goes into the problems we had in the medical field. But the American people are looking around, and we can't count on these basic things anymore. And Washington politicians are still going back and forth arguing about inflation, which is hitting people for real, a taxation policy, and this and that. But very few of them are actually talking about the deep fissures, the deep problems in the American system. And I think the consumer and the average person are starting to become aware of it. I mean, just a couple of years ago, Utah, you'd maybe come home for Christmas or Thanksgiving, and no matter how bad things were politically, you'd hear relatives say, well, don't worry, it's a pendulum, it'll swing back. And of course, that was never true. And finally, I think that optimism, that don't worry, it's all going to be better, has gone away, which is, you know, not a great between Christmas and New Year's message, but at least people being awake is an important change of this last year.
You know, I think that you're dead on with that. And one of the examples that I think, you know, we have to deal with or reckon with is that, sometimes we've gotten used to, I think, in problem situations in the past, the idea that the mob could kind of appeal to Washington and have some muddled solution offered on their behalf. But now I don't think that they feel that way anymore. I think instead they feel like they're screaming into the void. You know, whether it becomes to an issue like baby formula, or more recently, you know, there's been this issue with the hoarding of children's Tylenol and limits being placed in Walgreens and CVS at Kroger and other places on the number of pain relief for children purchases that you can make when you go, where you can only buy, you know, two bottles or the like, which, you know, for a family of multiple kids, you know, that's a very quickly run through in terms of the season around, you know, the holidays, as kids just inevitably bring home all manner of disease. And so for people who are struggling with that type of situation, they kind of look around and say, wait a minute, what's happening? Because if, you know, even if you had problems with who the president was, you know, whether it was George W. Bush or Barack Obama, whether it was Trump or even, you know, I think, you know, a lot of people thought that Joe Biden was going to bring some kind of sense of normalcy when they voted for him. But I think that in the opposite has happened. They actually feel how abnormal things are, that you walk into a store and you feel like, you know, these shelves are empty, and they were empty the last time I was here, too. And for very basic things that you buy over and over and over again if you have a family. And so I guess my question to you is, what can we do about something like that? And why aren't our leaders talking about that? As opposed to, you know, once again, you know, we saw Mitch McConnell come out and said the number one priority for Republicans is funding for Ukraine, you know, and I think that that's just, you know, fundamentally that's not true. But even if you are in favor of funding for Ukraine, you care a lot more about whether you can take care of your family and whether your kid can actually have Tylenol or not.
Yeah, but funding for Ukraine is easy. Just tinkering around the edges of tax policy is easy. The Democrats just passed an anti-lynching law. It's just like lynchings are still going on. Okay, that's easy. Who's going to vote against that? It's really difficult to solve the actual problems. I think, you know, there's a Republican senator I like, actually, Senator Kennedy, and he said one of the more incorrect things I've heard, and it kind of sums up the Republican thing, which is he said the fundamentals of our economy are fine. The fundamentals of this country are fine. It's just bad politics. And that's just fundamentally not true. We've had decades of a financial class and the political class selling out a working class and an industrial class for a buck. And it's hollowed out the country, and it's invited in swaths of drugs and suicide and despair and broken families. The fundamentals are extremely difficult. These are things that we actually have to talk about. I mean, take Pete Buttigieg, for example. That's just the supply chain. You shouldn't know who the Secretary of Transportation really is unless he's screwing up. Pete Buttigieg has been screwing up so badly that there are just supply chain crises in trucking and getting fuel and diesel and shipping all up and down. But there's like not really anyone who's sitting there saying Pete Buttigieg solve it, because no one actually thinks he could. It would actually take some more visionary leadership. I mean, Pete Buttigieg claims to be on maternity leave for the first crisis, but I wasn't even that upset. One, I'm kind of suspicious of the whole thing, but two, I don't think he would have been able to do anything had he been there, because he completely is in over his head. There are a couple politicians that are out there that are starting to talk about it, but it's politicians on this matter are going to follow the people, because you have to make hard calls. You can't just go out there and say Taiwan should be free from China to actually deal with their economic threats going on here. You have to go deeper, and the easy Democratic, liberal, conservative, Republican responses just don't cut it.
Yeah. You know, I think one of the things that we have to reckon with, too, is that in so many of these areas, we're dealing with people who are very, very insulated from the experience of life that most Americans have, meaning that, you know, they just are operating at a remove. And, you know, it's the kind of thing that we saw, you know, in prior years when it came to the, you know, idiocy of defunding the police or something along those lines. It's because they don't have that kind of experience in their community. You know, when we talk about the border crisis, for instance, and we see the reaction from Martha's Vineyard or from, you know, New York politicians when people are shipped up from the border, and they respond, you know, oh my gosh, this is incredible. We can't deal with this many people, when it's usually the number of people that have been, you know, coming across in the last 48 hours or so for a lot of these small communities in Texas. How can we have a political class that is actually more in touch with what people and have as the their priorities and concerns, as opposed to what they are told by Washington lobbyists and by their own paid consultants as to what those concerns ought to be?
You know, your story there just reminds me of when J.D. Vance wrote his book, Hillbilly Elegy, and you could get it out. You could get it at Koch conferences. It was handed out by Democrats, handed out by Republicans. And a lot of folks in this country just looked at them and said, hey, this is a great book, but did you really have no idea what it was like for poor white America? Like, did you actually, like, this is how poor people live. Yeah, no kidding. There's a huge amount of dysfunction. And these people thought he was a prophet. He was describing what had existed for years and years and years, if you just opened your eyes. And, you know, there are folks out there like Al Sharpton, who I think correctly from the beginning of the defund the police movement was calling those folks latte liberals who had no idea what it was like. And everyone acted really surprised when crime came up. I think in order to get these politicians who are willing to actually change things, and actually I'm glad that J.D. Vance is entering the Senate for this reason, you need politicians who look at this in a more radical way. The Democrats are very good at electing politicians who are here to make a difference. They're activists. They're willing to throw their careers on the line. They want to change this country. Republicans generally elect politicians who want to put a cap on their career, want to get have a good reason to have an oil painting above the fireplace. They would like new access. It's a status thing. And they like to take their majority and put it on the mantle and say, don't touch it. It's beautiful there. You need people who aren't simply trying to conserve what has been, because so much of what currently is just Potemkin villages. There's so much rot behind the facade. You need folks who are radicals, folks who look at this country the same way that the radical left look at the country in the teens and the 20s and said, this is a country that we fundamentally disagree with how it's run. We think the values are misaligned. We think that and we want to change everything. Now, the left at that point had some control over small amounts of the university systems. They had the Woodrow Wilson and some of the bureaucracies. They had a little bit of movement in the unions. But in general, they were in control of nothing. And within 50, 60 years, they started the fundamental transformation. But they looked at it that way. They said, we are on the outside looking in. We want to bring back this country. We can't just simply hold up the Federalist Papers or read the Constitution on the House floor like Kevin McCarthy's going to do. Nice sentiments, fine, but that's not going to change anything if half the country ignores it, and then the Republicans ignore it if it means more money in their pockets. We need to look at this as a more radical problem and have politicians who will speak honestly to it, which is why I was enjoying the candidacy of Blake Masters. Want to see what he's doing next. That's why I'm liking what J.D. Vance is going to be doing. He's made some really smart hires for folks who are really disruptive. And that's why, well, you know, at the end of the day, he's still just my favorite oligarch. Guys like Elon Musk taking the chair and throwing it out the mansion window and saying, hey, everything you thought was going on is going on in here. Those kind of the folks are getting a strong response from the American people because they're authentic.
You know, when you bring up a real problem here, though, for Republicans in the House, which is that, you know, given the fact that they have, a minority in the Senate and they have a bare House majority, they really aren't going to be able to move things the way that many thought that they were going to be able to do so in confrontation, direct confrontation with Joe Biden and the White House to try to unspool some of the problems that you're talking about there. Is there something that you see as an advantage or a potential bipartisan shift, something that could be put forward that would actually get enough support from a handful of Democrats, perhaps, who are trying to get reelected in what's going to be a very challenging 2024, that could potentially lead to a real confrontation that would be beneficial for the cause that you're talking about of a more radical approach to the way that we do our policies?
I have low hope. I'm not that much hopeful on this. Because the Democrats are very good at not giving any wins to the GOP, and the GOP are very good at not giving any wins to the GOP. And when you combine those two things, that's a problem. But I was hopeful, actually, at the end of the year with the omnibus, which, by the way, if you're one of those people who stayed at home and didn't vote for the GOP, even though you might normally, what better vindication did you have than Republicans trying to blast through this this trillion-dollar spending bill at the end of the year? But I was hopeful for a moment there that there was going to be some bipartisan movement, probably majority Democrat, on the Open Apps Market Act might be shoved in there, which would break the control that Apple and Google have over who's able to access you and your phone. We think that it's important what's going on in Twitter, and it is important because it controls a lot of the dialogue in the news media and government and corporate levels. But the fact that your phones are completely locked to anyone who Apple doesn't want to get in there or Google doesn't want to get in there, the fact that those companies control who's able to buzz your phone or ping you, whether you're at a funeral or reading the bedtime story to your children or sitting down at dinner, they can reach out and touch you with whoever they want and no one else at any time. That's a serious problem, and that's the kind of place where Republicans and Democrats both seem to get along, more Democrats actually than Republicans these days. But that would be something that I'd be interested in seeing. But even with that, pessimism is easier because it's less hurtful when you get disappointed.
let's go out on this, Chris. You know, I think that one thing that we can be positive about, after this year, is that there does seem to finally be an awareness on the part of all Americans, including older Americans, that there's just too much leadership in this country that is way too old, and that we need to have younger leadership and new generations of leadership. Is that something? That's the one thing that I'm most hopeful about coming out of this year. Do you share that hope?
You and I have been talking about this for years. That literally, Democrat and Republican leadership are a decade older than the Politburo when we were making fun of them. It's absolutely wild. And yeah, I think everyone's looking at this. I mean, Nancy Pelosi's going to step down. They're going to say, this is a new thing. I'm kind of curious about this. She was a great defender of democracy abroad. I didn't really notice that watching her in live action. But they're going to lionize her and say she was great. And I'll say, fine, whatever. I remember walking through Massachusetts after Ted Kennedy died, a pretty interesting and not necessarily moral character. And everywhere I looked was the last lion of the Senate. And we're going to have to go through that awkward phase. But the good news is, at the end of it, Ben, they'll all be gone. They won't be able to hurt us anymore. The bookstore windows will be annoying, yes, but a new generation can come up. And the benches are pretty slim on the Democratic side. So it'll be interesting to see how this vacuum is filled.
Definitely, and I'm sure that there'll be a lot of crazy to go around. You can follow Chris Bedford on Twitter at CBedfordDC. Chris, thanks so much for taking the time to join me today.
Thank you, Ben.
You are listening to Fox Across America. I am your host today, Ben Domenech, coming to you for Jimmy Failla, who we are out hoping is creating all sorts of havoc and having a lot of fun doing it. We'll be back with more right after this.
This is Fox Across America with Jimmy Failla.
He is one of those iconic figures that fans care about.
And we're back on Fox Across America. I'm your host, Ben Domenech, in for Jimmy Failla today. It has been a crazy year in politics, and I think that a lot of different developments have happened that are going to have major ramifications in the immediate and foreseeable future. But one of those obviously has to be the success of one Ron DeSantis in Florida. Obviously, DeSantis has been all over the airwaves over the past year. He's confronted one of the most powerful corporations in Florida, in Disney. He has gone after a number of different major hot-button issues. He has never been afraid of controversy, and he ultimately presided over an incredible night for Republicans in Florida, winning by double digits and being, really turning a state that had been a very slim margin, slightly red state in recent years into one that is firmly red, thanks in part to all the people who've moved there, thanks to his clear freedom-loving policies that he's had during the COVID period. If there is one political winner coming out of 2022, I think without question it has to be on the Republican side, Ron DeSantis, who's only going to receive, I think, continued calls to get into the 2024 presidential race. And I think it's very likely that he will. The big question is whether he can graduate to that national level with the kind of success that we've seen be in the case of other governors who've tried to make a similar jump. We all remember Scott Walker, who was supposed to be, the king of everything when it came to the 2016 contest, and yet he was out before people even started voting. Ron DeSantis will have to do things differently if he's going to succeed. You're listening to Fox Across America. I'm Ben Domenech, your host today. We'll be back with more right after this.
live from Everywhere USA. It's Fox Across America with Jimmy Failla.
And we're back on Fox Across America. I'm your host today, Ben Domenech, in Jimmy Failla's chair. Well, so that is that. Now we must dismantle the tree, putting the decorations back into their cardboard boxes. Some have got broken, and carrying them up to the attic. The holly and the mistletoe must be taken down and burnt, and children got ready for school. There are enough leftovers to do warmed up for the rest of the week. Not that we have much appetite, having drunk such a lot, stayed up so late, attempted, quite unsuccessfully, to love all of our relatives, and in general, grossly overestimated our powers. And that is probably the first and last time that W.H. Auden will be featured on a show hosted by Jimmy Failla. I want to talk to you a little bit about Christmas. It's a hard holiday, actually, for a lot of people. It gets harder as you get older. You have less time to enjoy it, less time to enjoy the kinds of things that you did as a child, and so you have to kind of set aside those different things in order to try to advance the pleasures of your kids and grandkids and the like. But I also think that it's an opportunity in the sense that you can make sure that the family traditions are passed down in a way that really gives due respect to those who've come before and those who invested so much time and effort in maintaining those traditions in spite of all the chaos that is inevitably surrounding you when it comes to the holiday season. I think that it's a real challenge, obviously, for people to deal with the loss that they've experienced, those who may have passed on in the intervening time, in the intervening year. Certainly there were families during the last several years who lost many people due to COVID or due to, you know, fentanyl, due to all sorts of different disease and the like. And that's very tough for all of us to deal with, you know, as adults, because you don't want to be down in the dumps about that kind of thing at a time when, you know, you would have appreciated the company of those who've gone on before you. But I think that one of the things that we can appreciate about this time is that these traditions are a way to reconnect with those who are no longer here, that you can remember the recipes, the ways that you shared in certain things, the ornaments that you had, the way that you would decorate or that you would sing, the songs that you would play, the movies that would you would watch inevitably with those who you no longer have with you. And I think it's also a time to assess the good things that happened in a year when there were so many things that were, frankly, quite bad for a lot of Americans. Challenges that they had to experience in their own lives and that they had to deal with in all different manner. You know, whether it's the challenges of the economy, the challenges of, you know, families that still are not unified given the fractious nature of our current political scene, or the challenges, frankly, of trying to adapt children back to the experience, the normal experience of getting an education, going to school, getting back out into life in ways that many of them, frankly, have not experienced to this point because they've been hidden behind masks. They've been unable to experience the classroom with their classmates and the like. One thing that I try to do at the end of every year when I'm just sort of seeing people and getting together with old friends, as one does around the holidays, is just try to ask them about one good thing that happened to them in their life this year. And what I find is almost inevitably, people have answers that are about things that are much more important than any of the trivial challenges, the minor inconveniences of life that plague us throughout the year. And so even if, you know, what's front of mind is the fact that you need to get the car fixed, or that you know, have some kind of problem with your house that needs to be dealt with, or that the neighbor is doing construction and it's making a racket, or that, you know, your dog has an issue, your cat has an issue, or you have family difficulties for all manner of reasons. If you put those things front of mind, those more important things front of mind, then often you find that everything else just is kind of swept away by them, that as much as you might dwell on the types of things that are challenges, everyday challenges for all manner of Americans, whether you're rich or poor, that the reality of what has happened to you is more beneficial. And so when I asked this question the other day online to my Twitter followers, I was deluged with people who were saying, I got engaged, I got married, I bought a house for the first time, I graduated from college, or in most cases, I had a child or I had a grandchild. And these are the things that I think we have to kind of keep in perspective, because as much as we have the concerns that come to us at the end of every year, when we see all of the challenges that are going to face us in the new year, when we try to set them aside in order to enjoy the company of our friends and family, I think that we have to understand that we should keep things in perspective, that life is hard, but that there's also great joy to be found in it, and that these deeper, more important things are often the things that we ought to keep at the center of our perspective, as opposed to the putting them to the side. In the past year, navigating in the wake of a number of different miscarriages, my wife and I were happy to have her, you know, finally, you know, as she has announced to the world, get pregnant with our second daughter, who will be arriving here in the coming weeks, who we hope to be healthy and happy and wonderful. And the challenge of preparing for that arrival is, of course, massive. You know, you have to set up a nursery. You have to, you know, buy all of these things that you thought you had from before, but that you somehow have lost track of. You have to, you know, put things together, and you have to, you know, take care of all manner of home life balance things all the way through, even as you're preparing for, you know, in our case, you know, the holiday season and travel and everything else that comes with that, and just the normal challenges of working and living, you know, in a very busy industry. But I try to keep in perspective the fact that, you know, right around the corner, there is going to be this little girl who I'm going to get to meet for the first time. And that means more to me than any of these other challenges, any of these other irritations. And as much as you might go a little crazy, like everybody goes a little crazy, when you're trying to unstring those lights, and even if you've checked them three times over, inevitably, when you get them around that tree or around your front porch, there's going to be a chunk of them that just don't light up, no matter how many different fixes you try to try. That you have to keep in perspective that these are minor inconveniences of life, and that the major things, the big things, are going well, and that those are the things that we should care about the most. I won't remember battling those lights, but I will remember, of course, the birth of our daughter in just a few weeks, and remember it as being one of the greatest things to ever happen to me. And so, knock on wood and prayerfully, I am grateful for a year in which, as many challenges as we've had as a people, as a country, as families, as friends, and as individuals, that this is also a year that has been very good in a great many ways, and that those are the things that we ought to appreciate. I also want to put in perspective for you all that this is a time when I think it's important to reassess the people that you have in your life. You know, one thing that I've learned over the years is that that there's a lot that can get sucked out of you and a lot that can get put back into your life with the friendships that you have and that you maintain. And I think that it's a good thing to kind of take stock, go down the list and say, who should I be spending more time with? Who would be helpful in the coming year? Who would be a benefit to me as a friend? And who is actually taking time away from people who I love, or, you know, being a negative influence or something like that? I think, you know, oftentimes we have these self-help experiences that are designed to try to help us, you know, reorient things or get a to-do list done, or to, you know, engage in self-improvement that starts in January, and people inevitably sort of slide off from it. But one thing that I think is really a great benefit to me and has been a great benefit to me this year is getting closer with some of the friends that I've had who I really realized that I ought to be spending more time with and ought to be associating more with in my life. And that's been a great benefit to me and to my family. And I think it's also something that is good to do on a regular yearly basis. I assess the number of things that I listen to. I assess the books that I read. I assess the subscriptions that I have, you know, at the end of every year, to see if I want to keep listening to, or I want to, you know, keep downloading that podcast or keep subscribing to that publication. And I think that when it comes to the relationships that we have, that's something that's good to do too. And to take a real good stock of whether what they're bringing into your life is something that's good and beneficial for both of you, or whether it's something that actually it's good to move on, it's good to grow, it's good to go in different directions. So with one final note on this, I think in 2023, something that I definitely want to be cognizant of is offering people more grace when I disagree with them. The natural assumption that I have, as I think a lot of people who work in media and politics, is that when you disagree with someone, that they've, you know, that they are aware of why you disagree with them, or that they're aware of all the different things that go into that belief. But I don't think that's always the case. And I think sometimes we jump to the conclusion that it is without the evidence that it actually is. Being able to talk to each other, even as we disagree, you know, especially for those whose, you know, presence in our life we value, is something I think is deeply important. And so as much as, you know, my advice is worth the amount that you just paid for it, I would just encourage you in the coming year to do these things and to think this way, because it's certainly been of great benefit to me in 2022, and I hope that it will help you too. I'm Ben Domenech. You're listening to Fox Across America. We'll be back with more right after this.
This thing is going to become gargantuan when the Son of Man comes.
You're listening to Fox Across America with Jimmy Failla.
And we're back on Fox Across America. I'm your host today, Ben Domenech, in for Jimmy Failla. I did want to address something that I think is kind of received a bit more attention than perhaps I thought it would. Maybe that's just because it's a slow news week. And that's this whole controversy over Whoopi Goldberg, who addressed in an interview to the Sunday Times, the UK newspaper, her previous comments that had gotten her in a lot of hot water over race and the Holocaust. Let's go back to those original comments. Cut 19.
The Holocaust isn't about race.
No.
It's not about
maybe
race.
It's about a different race.
But it's not about race. It's not about race.
What is it about?
Because it's about man's inhumanity to man. I was saying you can't call this racism. This was evil. Mm-hmm. This wasn't based on the skin. You couldn't tell who was Jewish. But it is indeed about race, because Hitler and the Nazis considered Jews to be an inferior race.
You know, this is a situation that has played out with Whoopi Goldberg before. She's talked about the Holocaust in some pretty irresponsible ways over the years. But one of the things that I think is interesting about this development is not so much what it says about Whoopi Goldberg as what it says about the nature of our media and the way that we are dealing with race differently now than perhaps we were a few years ago. You know, a few years ago, you could really get away with saying a lot of different things if you were operating from the perspective that you were someone who had been victimized historically or came from a victimized group. And that's something that just was a fact. It was something that people used, I think, to get away with saying some things that were pretty aggressive on race. And I just don't think that's true anymore. I think that now we're in a new reality where people are willing to sort of stand up and say, look, you know, you can't just say all of these things and think that you're going to operate from a position where you are untouchable and you don't have to be called on account of when you get things fundamentally wrong. Obviously, the Anti-Defamation League, you know, which is no friend of the right, and their CEO, Jonathan Greenblatt, were very critical of Whoopi Goldberg for what she said. And it led to this, you know, ultimate sort of apology where she said, you know, it was never my intention to appear as if I was doubling down on hurtful comments, especially after talking with and hearing people like rabbis and old and new friends weighing in. And what I think that the thing that we should take away from this, and that this is a good thing, is that no longer, I think, is there going to be just sort of a pass given to people based on their politics or based on race or anything like that when they say something that is just so aggressively and egregiously wrong. And I think that that's a good thing. It's an example, perhaps in this case, of the left eating its own, going after Whoopi Goldberg, who is an iconic you know, person for so many different respects, and EGOT winner, et cetera, you know, for something that she, you know, chose for whatever reason to bring back up in this interview with the Sunday Times. But I think that one of the things that we should understand about this is that it's good to go ahead and call people out based on the same ways that they would call other people out. You know, over and over again, This was a situation where, you know, we've seen, you know, people claim that that Republicans are racist. You know, the calls from Joe Biden this year about the laws passed in Georgia as Jim Crow 2.0 or what have you, the Jim Crow, Jim Eagle comment. I totally had forgotten about that. You know, those types of aggressive weaponization of America's racial politics is something that is absolutely terrible. But I also think that a response to that is not just to condemn it, is not to ignore it, but is to say, well, wait a minute, if you're going to start using that standard, well, that should be turned around. When you have the kind of votes that happened in Georgia, the overwhelming huge turnout that, you know, saw once again the defeat of Stacey Abrams in her race to be governor there. You know, that was something that had a few questions lobbed at the White House because of it. But it's also the sort of thing that, you know, if Joe Biden actually gave interviews or actually took questions from anybody, he should be called out on. You know, the people who are stoking racial resentment in America are often the same people who claim to be holier than thou, you know, people who are willing to sort of chide from a perspective that they are of higher morality than the people that they are chiding, who will, you know, frame the people on the other side as being, you know, Nazis or crypto Confederates or something along those lines. And I think that the best way to deal with that is to confront it, is to turn it around and to say, look, I'm confident that I'm not racist. I'm confident that I'm speaking from an informed perspective. But I'm also going to call you out when you engage in this same type of flippant behavior that Whoopi Goldberg engaged in, and demand that this be something that, you know, requires an apology or a retraction from someone so prominent. Keep in mind, she's on a program that is part of ABC News. It is not, it is a news program. It is not, you know, considered to be entertainment or under that umbrella. And I think one of the reasons that you've seen the conversation increase about the possibility that Bob Iger is returning to Disney in order to spin off potentially ESPN and ABC is in part because Disney understands that they don't want to have to deal with headaches like this. They want to use ABC and ESPN to promote their other properties, you know, to be part of this, you know, whole network that they're building with Disney Plus, and with their purchase and acquisition of so many different intellectual properties over the past several years under Iger's leadership. They do not want to have to deal with the kind of headache that comes from major figures in major movies, you know, having to apologize for, you know, once again, raising these types of controversial issues and putting them forward in ways that, frankly, just sound idiotic and sound ignorant of history. Unfortunately, you know, that's what Whoopi Goldberg had to experience this time around. But I do think that it is, again, about more than just her. It's about a shift in the way that people are willing to confront this type of idiocy when it comes to race relations in a more distinct and blunt manner, which I think is a good thing. You're listening to Fox Across America. I'm Ben Domenech. We'll be back with more right after this. And we're back on Fox Across America. I'm your host today, Ben Domenech, in Jimmy Failla's chair for the next chunk of time. Thanks for listening. I'm happy to be joined right now by Kara Kennedy. She is a staff writer at The Spectator. You can follow her on Twitter at Kara Alice Kennedy. Kara, thanks so much for taking the time to join me today.
Hi, Ben. Thank you for having me on.
So one of the things we've been covering, we've been looking back at 2022 during the course of the past couple of hours, that we haven't gotten to yet is what an incredible year it has been for a couple at the center of the conversation in celebrity and politics and race and just about every other aspect of anything that people care about. And that is, of course, Harry and Meghan. And I know that you've been concentrating on all the different things that they've been doing over the past year, a year in which their lives really were turned upside down in different respects, and which in which they seem to have beef with just about everybody around them. When you look back at the experience that they had in 2022, what sticks out to you as kind of the major storylines of what Harry and Meghan did that got them so much attention?
Well, that's a big question. I mean, it's been such a wild year with Sussex News, which is quite surprising because we didn't really hear from them much after the Oprah interview. We saw Harry attend things like the unveiling of the statue of his late mother, Diana, at Kensington Palace. And obviously, Harry attended the funeral of Prince Philip, which Meghan didn't go to either. And then 2022, it all kind of came pummeling back. Specifically, the last 6 months, we've seen a lot from the Sussexes. They were kind of quiet for the first half of the year. So in June, they attended the Platinum Jubilee with the rest of the royals, but we could tell things were tense already. They sat in a second row with Princess Eugenie and Princess Beatrice, and there was kind of little to no contact with the others. There were a few headlines of Meghan looking at Charles, and as soon as she looked at him, he kind of turned the other way. And then the big one was the Queen's funeral, where they both attended. They did the walkabout with Princess Catherine and Prince William. And again, that was very tense. I mean, there was one photo taken. The couples were really distant. They didn't really look at each other. And then it came out afterwards that there were tense words kind of between the couples, and there was little to no contact throughout the whole of the Queen's death. And then since then, again, you kind of thought, oh, what can they do next? Well, Meghan and Harry, the Netflix documentary, which it plummeted. I mean, I think they thought that it was going to do themselves a favour, but even staunch Sussex supporters by then were kind of like, oh, come on, guys, give us a break. And now you think the new year is the time for forgiveness. It's the time for getting on with stuff. And then on January 10th, we have Spear, Harry's up-and-coming memoir. So, yeah, it's been a big year for the two that wanted privacy.
So tell me the gossip surrounding the way that this Netflix special was put together and the reaction afterwards to it, because I agree with you. It seemed like they were assuming that people would watch because they would listen to their story and like them, when in reality it seemed like people were hate-watching it or watching it to see a train wreck.
Yeah, well, part of me thinks that it's obviously the most watched documentary on Netflix at the moment, and I think maybe there's more journalists in the world than I realize, because I feel like only journalists watch this to kind of write about it. And yeah, like I said, even very left-wing publications, it was called like a snooze fest, a cringe fest. Even the New York Times said that the total narcissists. I mean, it didn't seem to do well from any angle. It took longer than we thought it was going to. There were rumors surrounding that, the same as Spear, that Harry was kind of scrambling for stuff back, because the rumor is that a lot of stuff he said was in anger. And then when he realized that this was all going to be published, he kind of thought, oh, damn, I need to kind of get some of this stuff back. Otherwise, there is no going back. But what we did see from the documentary that we haven't seen before. So basically, all we've seen from them is them making baseless accusations without really saying who has said what or what has really gone on. But this time we saw the camps. So the Sussex camp and the Windsors, we learned who is on whose team and who is in and out. So in the Netflix documentary, what we really learned is that there is no going back for Harry, especially in terms of William and Catherine. He made them out to be literally the worst people on earth. Secondly, Charles, King Charles and Queen Camilla as well. They were kind of on the Windsor camp. What we did learn is that Beatrice and Eugenie are kind of Team Sussex more than any other part of the family, which was interesting. So yeah, we did learn something in the last 3 hours of the documentary. The first three were kind of like, oh, we've been wronged, we're victims, and it was just rehashing the same old stuff that they usually say.
The general sort of assessment seems in America seems to be that this is a situation where Harry is whipped, Meghan is guiding the course of what they do, that this is all about what she wants. And it's carefully constructed in order to achieve her aims. Do you share that view, or do you think that it's more complicated than that?
I think I did. I think I probably did think that at first. But now it doesn't even matter if this is Meghan driving it. Harry is letting her do it. Like, he has made his bed. Now he needs to lie on it. I mean, I was a very big supporter earlier on in the year. I wrote a piece saying that Meghan and Harry have exhausted Hollywood, but if Harry ever wanted to come back, then there would be a place for him. Now, this was June, and within 2 months, my opinion was completely different to that. There is no coming back for them at all. I mean, regardless of whether this started out as Meghan being the boss, Harry has let too much stuff happen now. I just think there's no coming back. I mean, especially in terms of, like, has just died. It hasn't been very long at all. I mean, now we've learned that she probably died of a very painful cancer in the bone, and the fact that those two allowed all of this stuff to happen in the lead up to her last few months, I mean, it just shows that they really have no respect for anybody apart from themselves. They don't care about anybody else's truth apart from their own, which differs massively to everybody else's truth. And I think that the fact that all of this was going on, now we've recently learned, when the Queen was very, very ill, I think that it has taken the one bit of respect we had away from Harry, and now we're kind of like, do you know what? You've made your bed, now you lie in it. We don't care.
I watched the King's speech, Christmas speech, and thought it was quite well done. I'm curious as to your opinion on the way that the other royals are responding to this, or in a sense not responding to it, not deciding to basically disengage and not rise to the bait that Harry and Meghan are putting out there.
Yeah, well, I think Charles's Christmas speech kind of did that too. Everybody, there was uproar because Harry and Meghan weren't mentioned. But I mean, why would they be? They made it very clear that they want nothing to do with this family. The turning point, I think, was Charles's first speeches as king after the Queen died, when he said the new Prince and Princess of Wales, and introduced Kate and William as the new titles, and then said, and I hope Harry and Meghan are happy in America. And that for him was kind of like, this is done. This is, I'm drawing a line under this, and they are done. So I was quite surprised at the uproar after the King's Christmas speech, because he didn't mention Harry and Meghan, but he made it clear all those months ago on his first broadcast that they were done. I mean, they have done nothing for the British people. I mean, this is fundamentally a speech for the British people. Charles spoke about how much he respects emergency services, nurses, and spoke about the hardships that people are going through between having to choose between heating or eating, and sympathise with that. I mean, Harry and Meghan have done nothing for the British people since January 2020 when they stepped down. So, yeah, I don't really see why anybody would have ever expected those to be involved in the speech.
Do you think that this is going to be something that in the long term results in a sort of less appreciation for the royals, or more? Meaning, does the fact that this kind of attempt to undermine them so directly and so transparently by Harry and Meghan, if it's unsuccessful, do you think there's kind of a rally around the royals' kind of response to it that basically says, yes, we're just not interested in this this thing that you're selling? You seem like a real train wreck of a couple, and we're not really interested in hearing from you anymore. Or is it the sort of thing where, you know, people will still buy the book just because they want that gossip?
Well, I mean, in terms of whether this will affect the royals, the royal family is like a phoenix that rises from the ashes every time. I mean, this isn't the first drama they've had. I mean, you look at the abdication, you look at Diana. Every time that you think, oh, there's going to be a real push for republicanism and there's going to be a real republican movement, they seem to just get stronger and stronger every time. I mean, at January 2020, when they first came out and stepped down, there was a fascination, I think, more than anything else. Why is this couple stepping down from this hereditary monarchy that seemed so amazing and so graceful? And then the Oprah interview, there was fascination. Oh, are the royals racist? What's going on? I think it was more inquisitiveness than anything else. But now, because everything is being repeated every few months, people are so exhausted. And I wrote this a few months ago, that you don't have to ask palace insiders, royal sources. All you have to do is walk into any pub and mention their names, and you are met by raised eyebrows, groans. People telling you to stop talking about them. People are just so exhausted. And there are only so many times that you can say the same thing, that you can speak your truth. I'm putting bracket marks around those because obviously it's not always the truth. But yeah, I mean, it's fear. If there's anything new in it, then people will buy it. But I just think that the majority of us is so exhausted with these peer right now. And I don't want to be overcritical of them. I always find myself writing critically about them. And then I think that if they did anything good, then I would write nicely about them. But until that day, it's kind of exhausting as a journalist. I don't want to write about them all the time. But yes, they are so hungry for commentary, and obviously it's my job to comment on it, it's a really vicious circle because they don't want anybody to talk about them, but they're just totally deplorable right now. They don't do anything good at all, and I just hope that after Spear, that's it for them. I mean, they alluded to the fans in the documentary that they're trying to move on and this is going to be the end of it, but I mean, you just don't know with these two. So hopefully after January 10th, when this memoir comes out, that will be the end of it all.
Something tells me that given the level of narcissism there, that you'll have plenty to write about in the coming year, 2023 as well. Kara Kennedy, thank you so much for taking the time to join me. You can follow her on Twitter at Kara Alice Kennedy. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Ben.
I'm Ben Domenech. You're listening to Fox Across America. We'll be back with more right after this.
Jimmy Failla.
Nice kid, but a little dumb.
You're listening to Fox Across America with Jimmy Failla.
And we're back on Fox Across America. I'm Ben Domenech in the seat today for Jimmy Failla. I want to thank you all for listening today as we've covered a lot of different things about 2022. I wanted to bring up one thing in particular that sticks out to me as just being a thought that I hope will have some impact with you. It seems to me that one of the things that's wrong about the way that we live our lives today in America is that we focus too much on the national as opposed to the local. We've focused so much on major stories that become, national level controversies, things that the president or the White House is expected to respond to. But, as one of our guests, Chris Bedford, earlier said, the truth is that you shouldn't really care about who the Secretary of Transportation is unless they're doing their job very badly. In fact, we should care a lot more about the things that are closer to us. And that's something that I hope we can get back to in the future. Unfortunately, right now, that's just not the case. Things are going so badly on a national level, on a comprehensive level, that we have to respond to it, I think, by nationalizing a lot of these debates in order to try to get the necessary response from people who matter and who can actually make changes. That's one of the reasons why I think it's so important, as we'll talk about tomorrow on Fox Across America, that what's happening at Twitter is happening and that we are actually getting the kind of information that we needed about the way that our own conversations have been affected, oftentimes without our knowledge, by major government entities participating in driving and determining who is allowed to speak and who is allowed to be heard. I also think that this is a situation which is unfortunate for America, because we have thrived as a nation in which the people of this country, our citizens, have had the time and the energy to focus on the things that are closest to them, on their family, their community, their church, their temple, their mosque. And I think that one of the things that we have gotten away from, unfortunately, is that type of localism in the way that we are governed. It's a lot harder to hate your neighbor than it is to hate someone who seems at a distance, who seems, unlike anyone that you actually know in your life. It's a lot easier to get along with people when you actually see them regularly, when they're, around you, when they are watching your kids or, helping out in your community, when you're, trading the responsibilities of taking care of a little league team and the like. One of the things that I hope that we can get back to in future years is more localism, is more of a closer understanding to, the people who are around us, and not necessarily getting caught up in the way that I think that we have been too much in recent years in these national quarrels and fights where all that really matters is the color tie that you're wearing, whether it's blue or whether it's red, as opposed to what you're actually saying in terms of the ability of people to judge what's going on and to assess you as a person, as opposed to just someone who, you know, has, you know, at the center of their mind either the best for America or the worst, depending on what party you're in. That's something that I think, you know, I try to work on myself, and I hope that you will as well in 2023. And part of that, I think, is just getting to know people around you, having places that you go to regularly, and being able to have conversations with people that, you know, aren't just broken down according to the bumper stickers that they have on the back of their car. That's something that I try to do in my own life and that I hope you will as well. We may not always succeed at it because it's very easy to get, you know, driven up, to get spun up by all of the different dramatic and very significant fights that are happening in America today. But I think that a little less hate and a little more grace is something that is easier to show when we actually view people as being our neighbors, as opposed to just being the avatars of everything that we hate when we turn on the channel that we don't like. It's been a pleasure to talk to you all today and to share some of these thoughts about 2022, about the politics of it, the celebrity of it, and some of the craziness that went down. But I also want to remind you that this is something that, you know, we ought to do, I think, on a regular basis, to take a step back from the constant, you know, refresh of everything that's going on, just in the most recency-biased approach to assessing what matters in the news, and have a little more perspective on the things that matter the most. I'm Ben Domenech. You've been listening to this edition of Fox Across America. I'll be back tomorrow with more back in Jimmy Failla's seat. Until then, I hope you have a blessed day.
I'm Charles Payne. Listen to my Unstoppable Prosperity podcast so I can get you making money right now. Whether stocks are hitting new all-time highs or in free-fall mode, opportunities abound. So why are so many potential investors still sitting on the sidelines? In a new season of my podcast, I'm going to get you in the game. After 38 years on Wall Street, I'm ready to impart some lessons and get you invested in the greatest wealth-generating machine in history. Listen anytime, everywhere at foxbusinesspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your favorite podcast.
Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.